Grade 4 Conference, Lecture 62, Zoology Part 9. Now, I've said more than once that zoology is like a threshold, like a doorway, an opening into all of the natural sciences that the children will study. And in a certain way, it is perhaps most endowed with connections to the other sciences of everything that they'll work with. So we are going to look at the animals. Well, that's going to involve what they eat. That may connect us with other animals, but it certainly will connect us with botany as well. We'll be talking about the environs in which the animals are meant to be or in which they flourish. That may bring us into connection with geography, with geology, grade 6. Could even talk about the zodiacal signs and how peoples around the world very often have connected these 12 great constellations with animals. That's why they're called the zodiac, the animal circle, connecting with grade 6 astronomy. Talking about the relationship of animals to different climates or to weather changes within a given climate in one part of the earth or another. Eighth grade meteorology, and of course throughout the connection with the human being, seventh and eighth grade physiology and anatomy. So very wonderful, and it's good to bring one or another image to the children and say, we'll learn more about this in this or that science, or when you're teaching those sciences in the upper grades, to look back and not let the children forget that they've already heard something about this. A seed was planted 2, 3, 4 years before in their wonderful zoology block. So let's start with something of a geological or hydrospherical quality, the ocean, and the animals that live in the ocean. Here, of course, we have a tremendous variety, a tremendous possibility, but let's just talk, even before we get into the specific animals, a little bit about the ocean itself. And it's very interesting. In the late 19th century, there was a group of zoologists who were working on developing a kind of artificial ocean water so that in the aquariums that were starting to develop at that time, that people could keep saltwater fish alive and study them or just enjoy their presence without having to constantly transport water from the ocean across great distances. Not much longer after that, a group of physiologists were working on understanding the composition of the blood so that they could create for emergency situations or in veterinary situations something that would have the same substantiality as the blood. And when the results of their work were published, what was most interesting was that they discovered that the mineral composition of salt water and blood, or seawater and blood, was not that different. Now, other aspects of them, of course, were very different. But in terms of fluids with mineral content, it went like this. Blood was about 80% NaCl, sodium chloride, table salt. Seawater, 78%. Blood, 4% potassium chloride, KCl. Seawater, same amount, 4%. Blood, 4% calcium chloride. Seawater, 2%. The only really big difference was that blood is low in magnesium chloride, only 2%. Seawater is very high in magnesium, 15%. We see that in sea animals as well. But isn't this interesting? that very much as the Norse myths have told us, what was it of Ymir that was spilled out and became the great waterways? His blood. So we might say that the blood of a very, very ancient being went from inside to outside that being, and that became the seawater, the repository of great, great life forces in the earth itself. We could say that we carry the sea, the ocean, within us, within our blood. So it shouldn't surprise us then that we see within the ocean all kinds of creatures who, the lower aspect of sea creatures, not the higher fish and not the mammals like whales and dolphins, but the lower aspects of life in seawater, it looks like a whole lot of organs floating around. The jellyfish, for example, which is on the increase, interestingly enough, which the physiologist Ernst Haeckel called a heart, a sea heart. And it actually, its whole physiology resembles that of the heart. Or sometimes it's been called a brain. Some varieties of jellyfish have the look of a kind of loose brain floating around. And we can think how in our head, the brain is indeed suspended in water. Otherwise, it would crush all that was below it with its weight. So here we have a very nice picture. Not that we need go into the chemistry, but we can just say that blood and seawater have many, many similarities. But what lives within us as organs that are tightly packed inside us, they flow out, and we can look at all kinds of sea creatures that look like intestines or look like a liver or things like that. They are just out there, disconnected from one another, and also they are cold-blooded. They do not have an inner warmth. It's whatever the temperature of the ocean might be. Whereas our blood is warm. Ours is imbued with a kind of important inner fire. And as we live in the ocean water, we might want to take a look at the octopus and describe to the children how, like most sea creatures, the octopus does not have limbs. That sea creatures, so many of them, are very much like heads that are just floating loosely in the water along with the other organs. And of course, the children might immediately protest. An octopus has 8 legs. It's got 8 long legs that reaches out for things. But when we look at those apparent legs carefully, we realize, first of all, that they're completely connected to the head of the octopus. Where's the trunk? Where's the central part that mediates between those apparent limbs and the octopus head? It's not there. And besides, they have suction cups on them. Great things to have if you need to maneuver your way around rocky areas, which octopi do. And if you're trying to catch something and hold on to it, also very good. But actually, the suction cup, which comes from the word to suck, that reminds us of our lips. And yes, the 8 seeming legs of the octopus, the tentacles, are actually extensions of its lips. The octopus is actually one big mouth on a big head. And we could also look at the way in which those lips are used to gather up stones, sometimes of impressive weight, and how the octopus actually builds itself a nest in which it waits, ready to give off its ink in case it needs to camouflage itself or in order to sneak upon its prey. and bring it in. And this is certainly a big part of sea life, that so much of what lives in the sea is of a predatory nature. And the bigger look for the smaller, and then there's one bigger than they who looks for them, and so on. This remarkable picture of a kind of endless digestion process that's going on, often without the animals even having to do much hunting, but just floating along, moving forward in the water, opening their mouths, and they are fed by the kind of bloodstream of the ocean itself. Or we could look at another interesting sort of creature who alternates between the seawater and the freshwater. And that, of course, probably comes to mind for you, the salmon, with its remarkable pattern of being born, of going into salt water, and then having to completely recapitulate that, but in backwards order, going up and up and up, sometimes very treacherous streams, growing weaker, being attacked, but nonetheless making its way up at that important period of time where it must lay its eggs. And we can see how the fish and all sea creatures give their eggs over to the world. They don't sit on them. They don't spend any time with them. With some fish, the eggs are laid and the fish is gone immediately. Doesn't even seem to be aware of what it's done. And of course, because the eggs are at the mercy of all of the predators in the sea, or in the case of salmon, at the mercy of birds as well, who are waiting, watching the salmon's every move, we can see at that time that they must lay many, many eggs for the survival of just a few. And yet they do survive. They do go forward. If we're going to teach the salmon, and it might be that if you're in British Columbia or if you're in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, or if you're teaching in Scotland, wonderful how international we can be, you may want to share the story of the salmon with the children. But it's always good to find another creature similar or even better yet, contrasting in one way or another. So we're going to talk about not only the salmon, but also the eel. The eel is the opposite of the salmon. It doesn't spawn in fresh water, but rather somewhere in the ocean, generally believed to be in the depths of the Sargasso Sea, but nobody actually knows where eels come from. They are born in a place still to this day unknown to us. And one reason they're unknown is because after their birth, they are incredibly tiny, barely visible little fish. And they get swept by the Gulf Stream, which of course discovered by Ben Franklin, something we'll take up in eighth grade meteorology perhaps, the Gulf Stream, which moves from southwest to northeast. And they move slowly. They're not impelled very much by their own fins, which are minuscule, but rather they're really swept along. For one summer, for two summers, for three summers. Not only are they tiny, they are essentially transparent, so that even predators can't quite see them. And in these three summers, unlike so much of what's true in the animal world, in the human world as well, they don't grow. They remain pretty much the same very, very tiny size. And then after that third summer, their little bodies start to assume the shape of a kind of pipe, a kind of cylinder, almost like a very, very thin pale cylinder of glass. And now they find themselves closer to the coasts. And they begin to move, not with fins, but rather just by wriggling their way through the water. And they begin to look for fresh water, the water that's pouring out of rivers, streaming along from the coasts into the ocean. And now they enter the mouths of rivers. Sometimes they have to climb over dam walls. They have to find their way over all kinds of natural and man-made obstacles. And many of them die at this time. Just as the salmon die when they are trying to go into fresh water and lay their eggs, so the eels die as they are growing up, as they are themselves a few summers separate from their egg existence. They're devoured by birds, they're devoured by animals, and human beings too. In some lands, eels are regarded as a great delicacy. And some of them, however, manage to reach the beds of the rivers and find their quiet, stealthy way there. And there they will stay in calm, fresh water after those years in the ocean. Now they're at home in fresh water. They eat, they grow fat and rounder and rounder. They don't like the cold weather very much. They don't like the river water starting to freeze. So they sink down into the mud and they hibernate. Now, the children may already have heard about hibernation and understand what that means, but if this is the first time that you're mentioning it, let them know that it's not only sleep, it's a much, much deeper sleep than we would ever experience. It's very near death. Their body temperature, in the case of an eel who's cold-blooded anyway, it's not such a big difference, but a hibernating mammal's body temperature goes very far down. The heartbeat slows, the circulation, the breathing, everything very, very slow. So it needs no food, and it's in a state of very, very deep sleep. But when the warm weather returns, then the eels get active again. And eels are amazing. They are, though they can be, of course, caught by animals or human beings, they can survive water that's quite polluted. It's often amazing when many fish die in some of the worst spills of oil that the eels somehow, at least in great numbers, are surviving. And when the ponds dry up in a great drought, the eels will burrow in the mud, go as deeply as they must, so that they will survive until the next rainfall. And then they feel the need to move away from the rivers, to leave the safety of their pond or their riverbed and go out to the sea. By now, the eel is 8 years old. Think of that. It's lived almost as long as you have. Very, very unusual for a sea creature. And their long journey begins. Now, instead of looking for the daylight and living in the warmth of the sunlight, they travel by night. They seek darker places. They go straight for the deepest water they can find. Down, down, down they go until their dark bodies disappear in the dark depths of the sea. And all that we know is that in the depths of that dark sea, they are going to give birth to the baby eels, to those transparent, tiny little creatures who will themselves now begin the long 8-year journey back to the fresh water and then back to the sea again.